Well, hello, friends. Before we start, Titus O'Reilly here. And if you haven't already heard, we have a membership program, Bizarre Plus, where if you want even more from Sports Bizarre, you can get it. As a member, you'll get a weekly bonus podcast of Mick and I talking absolute nonsense. It's a lot of fun. You get access to all the past bonus episodes too. So there are plenty there. So if you've missed out on them and you want to hear them, becoming a member means you get access to all of that. You get behind the scenes access. We've got a fortnightly newsletter that goes out to members that I write every fortnight with all sorts of information in it. You get access to the members only chat room where we have lots of fun on there, lots of behind the scenes stuff. You can vote on future episodes and you get early access to any live shows that myself is doing or Sports Bizarre Live podcasts that are coming up this year. So tons of reasons. We'd love to have you as a member. Bizarre Plus, and the link is in the show notes.
It's Sports Bizarre.
Get into it.
Some of these stories you would say that cannot be true.
I'm fine to us.
The hunt for the weirdest.
This is madness.
It's a masterclass in how not to do things.
The most hairbrained scheme I've ever heard.
Strangest.
Oh, wow. You can't make this up.
Things are only going to get more bonkers.
Most unbelievable.
Most genius thing I've ever heard. You say evil, I say brilliant.
Stories to ever occur.
An unparalleled array of deadbeats.
A mecca for colourful characters.
In the world of sport.
Had a taste for testicle soup.
Can I just stop you for a second?
Don't act like you've never done this.
Sports Bizarre.
Opened his mouth and a sparrow flew out. Slept face down with a compass to make sure that his head was pointing north. He hit so many sixes into the members that they retreat him to the bar.
I'd better lie down after that.
It's time for the leaders of the hunt.
It's 10 cent beer night at the ball bar.
It's Titus O'Reilly and Mick Malloy.
Welcome back to the latest episode of Sports Bizarre. I'm Mick Malloy. We're with Titus O'Reilly. You left us halfway through the Babe
Didrikson.
Didrikson, because yeah. Didriksen being Norway, because she was Norwegian
background.
And she's gone from Norway to Texas, and she's taken on any sport
she
chooses.
Won two gold medals, a silver medal. She should have won three gold medals. She's won basketball national championship.
She's resurrected vaudeville.
She's resurrected vaudeville. She's played baseball against the men and done pretty well.
Yeah. Been absolutely railroaded out of certain or discouraged from entering certain
sports. Weirdly beloved and not loved, depending on who you are. So the administrators of a lot of sports didn't like her and certain sections of the country didn't like her. But then others, she was absolutely beloved by the public and others. And the main thing was her conformity to what was seen as feminine standards of dress and behaviour, because she'd swear as well.
And you were suggesting the implication.
The implication that is that there, and we'll get into her sexuality as we go on, but the implication was they thought that she was a lesbian, but they wouldn't say that outright. Yeah. So they'd say she was too manly and things like that. And they didn't like that a lot.
Not ladylike enough.
A lot of other people, though, and top sports writers like Grantland Rice, we talked about, and a lot of administrators, though, were the opposite. There's a large majority loved her, but there were moments in her career.
How much respect to those guys in particular do you have? Because, I mean, you've said it before. Everyone thinks that looking back retrospectively, they'd be working on the Underground Railway or whatever.
If I was there, I'd have been have the views I have now.
But to actually be there and to be as unencumbered by those dickhead views is truly amazing.
And this is where she was a true trailblazer on so many levels, because she did recreate in people's mind what a female athlete could be and do. Both, not just her appearance, but she was a powerful player in every sport she did. She used power and strength where women were sort of seen as being agile and swift.
Yeah.
She was like, no, I'll hit home runs, thank you very much.
Yeah.
So she really changed this view. And the fact she did weights and ran all the time and kept herself fit and built up her bulk, this was stuff that people were like, which now you'd have to
standard operating procedure.
So she decided to do golf. Now, what she did in turning to golf is she practiced for hours. So they would say that every day she would hit 1,500 balls every day.
Wow.
And in her only 11th game, it wasn't like a professional game or a high-level amateur game, but just playing, they said that she produced a 260-yard shot from the first tee which is 240 metres.
Yeah.
So she's crunching the ball.
Anyone I know would take that.
Yeah. So in 1935, she's built this up and she enters the Women's Texas Amateur Tournament at the River Oaks Country Club in Houston. They have looked at her amateur status because remember she was denied her amateur status after being in that ad. They reviewed it, the golfing authorities did, and said, no, we for the good of the game, we think you can play in the amateurs.
Welcome aboard. Welcome Thank aboard. You.
She turns up in Houston at the River Oaks Country Club for this first official tournament she's in. It's an amateur tournament. Class discrimination becomes a problem here. So instead of her being a woman.
Gender lines.
It's more her working class background is picked upon because you got to remember this was when, I mean, long before African Americans could play, it was also poor people weren't really allowed to play. It was a country club for rich people game, not a
what's she doing
widespread.
Here?
So Peggy Chandler, who was one of the other, she was a socialite in Dallas, but one of the top golfers. Like
Southern Belle.
Yeah, exactly. She said about Babe, we don't need any truck driver's daughters in our tournament. What I love about these times is they didn't even hide it.
No, there's
it's
no
not,
even attempt
it's not to subtle get, racism
I'm,
or.
I'm just going to conceal it. Here's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
We don't want you
because you're
and
poor.
Your type in here.
Yeah. The crowd, however, love Babe. They're thrilled. So even though these women are annoyed, more people show up to watch this golf tournament than ever before. They all follow Babe. Her gallery is the biggest by a mile.
Thank God for the general public.
They cheer her all the way, and she actually defeats Chandler.
Ah, well, there's the karma bus. Bang.
The problem is it's a hollow victory because all these complaints come in from the upper class competitors and the United States Golf Association look at it and they have so much pressure from these rich socialites that they rescind Babe's amateur status, which they just cleared. So suddenly they say, you're not. They say you have to sit out 3 years to get your amateur status back.
Oh, my God.
So in the meantime, she competes in the Los Angeles Open, which is a men's PGA tournament.
So, and just for context, the professional circuit's not as competitive as the amateur circuit at that time.
There's not a women's LPGA at this point.
Yeah.
So it's just amateur for women, but there's a men's professional one, and they let her play in one. And this is no woman competes against the men in the PGA until 2003. After Babe does in 1938.
Incredible.
Right? So she's the first person to ever do it. And so she's a bit of a novelty for the tournament.
Yes.
They sort of see it as the benefit.
Why not?
Best female athlete in the country competing against the men. Baseball did it. Who doesn't want to see this, right? Meanwhile, she's not allowed to play with the women because it's a separate body and they've said no.
Yes, yes, yes.
So she's put in a playing group of three. One was a guy called C. Pardee Erdman, who was a Presbyterian minister and a professor of religion at Occidental College. The other was a man named George Saharis, who was a professional wrestler. Now, the organisers thought it was hilarious to put a reverend, a professional wrestler and Babe together. They thought...
Is the wrestler a good golfer?
He was a decent enough golfer, yeah.
But he's there as a wrestler.
He's there as a wrestler. And
this is a bit of a celebrity pro-am kind of vibe.
Yeah, wasn't it? Yeah, before they had those, this was the occasional just enter an interesting group, right? So the organisers thought this was hilarious. The gallery agreed. They had the biggest crowd following them, even though they weren't the best golfers by a long mile. Right?
Fantastic.
George Saharis, the wrestler, hears of this group and says, I'm not playing with no damn woman. And they say, come on, George,
calm down.
You know. They rock up, the three of them. They've never met. Sports photographers are all there and they egg on George and say, come on, do a wrestling hold on Babe. Say, like, gets her in a headlock. And she's up for it all because she's a vaudeville back. You know,
exactly.
So him and her are pretending to punch each other in the photos and headlock and they start getting along like a house on fire, right? They're having a ball. And he suddenly thinks, oh, she's actually fun. She shot an 84, he shot an 83, and the Reverend shot a 75. He was the only one.
The Reverend's taking the chockies.
But George and Babe become smitten with each other by the end of the first round.
A round of golf can do that to you.
You've fallen in love in a round of golf?
I've fallen in love. But you know in 5 hours of golf, four hours of golf, you know whether you like someone or you don't.
You reckon it's a good barometer.
It's the greatest insight into whether you're going to see this person ever again or not.
See, I'm terrible at golf. No one would like
you'd
me,
still be fun on the golf course. You'd be annoying.
Well, I'd be in the bloody trees the whole time.
You'd be wearing plus fours, I reckon. Oh. And you'd still be using the hickory shaft.
Oh, God.
Maybe smoking a pipe.
Exactly.
Wearing a sleeveless vest with a check pattern.
Yeah, exactly. It'd just be it's all about the look.
Yeah. A Sam Snead style hat.
You reckon that would be I'd look like Bagger Vance, that movie, Legend of Bagger Vance. So after a few months, they're engaged, and they marry 11 months later on December 23, 1938. This is how
Hang on, how long before they get engaged?
Just a couple of months, and then in 11 months, they're married.
Because you hadn't approached her sexuality.
She has shown no interest in men up to this point. She meets George and marries him.
Right.
The view and my reading of it, and I suspect that George and her were very much in love, but I don't think it was a sexual love. I think they both got along like a house on fire. There's no
enjoyed
doubt.
Enjoyed each other's company.
There was no doubt they were.
Loved out together.
There was no doubt they were basically the love of each other's life. Well,
what are you basing this on?
The way he supported her, they hung out all the time, the way they did dancing together, they did all sorts of things together, businesses together. They basically.
No PDAs.
But they had no babies. Yeah. They tried to adopt and they weren't allowed. That was mainly because the rules were incredibly strict back then. But it doesn't seem at any point that there was really a sexual component to it. I think he loved her and she loved him, and I think it was a useful cover for her. And we'll get into a bit of this as well in this, that suddenly it took away a lot of the things.
It was quite common at the time.
But there's no doubt that she was the love of his life and vice versa.
There's a lot of cover stories going on
in
that
era, wasn't
there?
I think there's no doubt if she was live today, she'd just be a lesbian out of the closet, proud, wouldn't have been an issue. Back then, that wasn't even an option for her. And George and her, I think if it was now, he would have been like her closest friend and partner, but not necessarily a married and romantic partner.
Yeah.
But at the time, this was the thing, because they get along. Option. You'll see how much they get along and how, like, it's a very successful marriage in every other way.
Okay.
So Time magazine report on the wedding.
Yes.
They write, married Mildred Babe Dirksen, famed woman athlete, 1932 Olympic Games track and field star, expert basketball player, golfer, javelin thrower, hurdler, high jumper, swimmer, baseball pitcher, football halfback, billiardist, tumbler, boxer, wrestler, fencer, weightlifter, adagio dancer, and George Zaharas, heavyweight wrestler.
Great. So what a union.
Now, let's get into George. So George Zaharas was born on February 28th, 1908 in Colorado. His family were Greek immigrants. His real name was Theodore Vitianis. Grows up to be this big, strong man. Yes. So he was literally like about 136 kilos and about 6 foot. So big and muscle early on. And by 1928, he'd become a professional wrestler. He started wrestling under the name Ted Victory. But his promoter changed his last name to Zaharas, which is Greek for sugar.
Okay.
So George Zaharas is a completely made-up name, but he used it the rest of his life, right? He was nicknamed the Crying Greek from Cripple Creek.
Fantastic.
And he played a bad guy.
He was a villain.
He was a heel. Yeah, he was a bad guy.
He was a Greek.
Guy.
That's why they wanted to change his name to Zaharas. Yeah, it's like the Iron Sheik.
Iron Sheik and
all
that.
All of a sudden you're going to be
the Crying Greek.
Nasty pasty.
And it was the Crying Greek from Cripple Creek because he would.
Hey, they've got him in his name.
Yeah.
They're even just.
And he'd play up to the bad loser.
Yeah,
he was
storm
the,
out
you
of
know,
the ring.
Cheat.
He'd cheat towards the end.
Gouge eyes.
But no one calls themselves the Crying Greek.
I know.
They've given him that. They haven't even allowed him to.
The Crying Greek from Cripple Creek. He was also known as wrestling's meanest man and the Greek hyena.
Oh, the Greek hyena.
This is an example of an article written about him. George Crybaby Zaharas, the pouting pachyderm. Now, pachyderm's an elephant, or a hippo. With the happy faculty of making the wrestling customers hate him even before he launches some of his quaint routines, such as sticking his thumb in his opponent's eye or kicking him in the head as they lie prone on the canvas.
Fantastic.
So he would do all that stuff, right? In one match, after the match, he'd lost and he was having, so playing up to the crowd, he had a hissy fit that he'd lost. And they love it when he, the more angry he was after a loss, the more they love it. He went into the dressing room and began to put on a show that the patrons outside could not see but could certainly hear. He crashed around and yelling and overturning chairs made it sound like D-Day was taking place in that little room. The old building couldn't take it and the dressing room partially collapsed, bringing lumber and plaster down on the wrestlers' heads. After rescue by police and firemen, George yelled, "Why don't you folks demand that the commission build a decent dressing room for the wrestlers?" A policeman pulled the last bits of debris off Zaharis and replied, "I happen to be the commissioner and you'll be getting a bill for a new building tomorrow."
You cry, baby.
One of his most celebrated bouts was in 1932. He fought Jim Londis at a sold-out Maple Leafs Gardens in Toronto. He lost.
Yes, of course.
George lost. The audience was 14,500. It was the highest attendance for any wrestling match in North America that year. George said, "I became the busiest wrestler of them all from 1932 to 1938. I wrestled every night of the week, all the time, all over the United States. They reckon he wrestled in 7,000 matches during his career, 25 bouts for the world title, which he never won." Wow. Because he's the bad guy.
He's bums on seats though, isn't he?
And this is when people this day pretend it was real still, yeah, right? So he'd play up to it, right? He also became a sports promoter. So he would, by the time he meets Babe, he's making a fortune.
He's going all right.
Because he's doing well as wrestling, but he's also promoting other wrestlers and other sports. So he's a smart businessman. The minute he marries Babe, he decides to quit wrestling and put his own career on the back
to manage
burner.
Her.
And says, "I'm going to promote your achievements and sacrifice my own. We're going to get you up to scratch on golf."
Oh, George.
"And I'm going to make money." So, because at the time there wasn't heaps of money coming in through the golf yet. And he stops doing media and all that sort of stuff. And this is incredibly rare at the time, right? For a man to be the one that goes, "I'll put you first."
Yeah.
Babe's career starts to soar. He manages as well to bring in money. A tailoring shop, a cigar store in Denver, a woman's sporting clothing business in Beverly Hills, and a golf course in Florida where they eventually moved to. Babe takes the home very importantly. They had a modern kitchen she installed and they painted the dining room and the kitchen. It was called a screaming yellow. Right. She says, "It's kind of loud, but you get used to it. The only door in the house was on the bedroom because she hated doors and believed they cluttered up the place."
Right.
Zahara slept in a double bed and she slept in a single, which is telling, right?
Yeah.
So then she's practicing, and in 1940, with George getting her to play all the time, she decides that she's going to feminize her image. So she's now married to George. She grows her hair a bit longer, starts wearing some makeup, more appropriate,
play the game,
longer dresses.
Think?
Yeah, she started doing that. George would start accompanying her to these early tournaments.
Yes.
And the media noted that his affectionate way of greeting her was to put her in a headlock. So during World War II, then hits. So her career, which is she's waiting for the amateurs to let her back in, World War II hits, which stops a lot of stuff. Babe starts giving golf exhibitions to raise money for war bonds because she's still a huge star. And in 1943, the United States Golf Association finally says, "Okay, your amateur status is reset. You can now enter all our tournaments."
Okay, here we go.
George follows her to everything. And in 1944, she plays her first, because the war's been on, she plays her first proper tournament. It's the Women's Western Open golf event in Chicago. George follows her around the course, blowing smoke from his cigar to show her the wind direction. And reward her on the winning green with a mighty hug and a massive kiss.
She wins.
And she wins.
Fantastic.
1945, the war's ended, and she starts to emerge as the most successful and popular women golfers of all time. In 1945, she plays flawless golf. She's named Woman Athlete of the Year, not just in golf. And she goes on and wins consecutively. I think she wins about 17 straight tournaments she wins, including the British Women's Amateur Open.
Sure.
So she's going over to Britain and winning too. Turns professional finally again. She's now won enough at the amateur level. And they reckon she's earning $100,000 in 1948 through her promotions and exhibition, while golf was paying her $3,000.
Incredible.
So she's like
she's
that
huge.
Big.
She's
right?
bigger she's than
huge.
The game.
Yeah. She becomes the leading money winner on the women's professional circuit. And in 1948, she wins her first US Women's Open.
Yes.
You got to remember, she only started playing properly 8 years before. The World Championship and the All-American Open. she's doing all these things where she's driving these huge, she's like a John Daly type. All the other women are doing these like graceful strokes and that. She's just muscling.
Boom, shakalaka.
Yeah. The great Texan golfer Byron Nelson, who was very famous, yes, said at the time that he knew of only 8 men who could outdrive her. And she said, it's not enough to just swing at the ball. You've got to loosen your girdle and really let the ball have it. Zahara said in order to win, Babe drove balls with taped, bloodied and sore hands because she just was such a grueling thing. And she said, I've always been a fighter. Ever since I was a kid, I've scrapped for everything. I wanted to win every time. If a game is worth playing, it's worth playing to win. Babe would often tee off and she'd be the first to tee off in a tournament.
Yes.
And then regardless of where she was on the board or that day or whatever, she would turn to the gallery and say, come on, folks, follow me and I'll show you how to play this game. So she was showbiz, right?
She's playing to the gallery.
In 1949, her and George moved to Tampa, Florida, and they bought the Forest Hills Golf and Country Club. It had riding stables, all this, and it had this massive, beautiful two-story clubhouse, which had a ballroom and 10 houses scattered around it, and they live in one of those houses. They had a sign at the front saying, the home of Babe and George Zaharis. Apparently, they just had a great community there. She could beat all the men in the golf club.
Of course she could.
And friends would say she would play golf, beat them all, curse with the men all day, have a beer, and then go have tea with the women. Now, on top of this, there was created the WPGA in 1948, which was an attempt to build up women's golf.
Yep.
But by 1950, it had collapsed. So Babe and George helped set up the Ladies Professional Golf Association, or the LPGA.
Which
so
is
she
still
starts that. In 1950, while she's doing all this, she completes the Grand Slam of the three women's major tournaments in golf at the time, the US Open, the Title Holders Championship, and the Women's Western Open. She went on to win the LPGA Championship 10 times.
Unbelievable.
She was voted the world's greatest women athlete of the first half of the 20th century by the Associated Press, and she was named the Women's Athlete of the Year by the Associated Press in 1932, 1945, 1946, 47, 50, and 54.
This is incredible. Why do I not know this?
As a pro, she won 31 tournaments and 10 of them were majors, including the US Women's Open 3 times. She was the first to ever win the Grand Slam. She was one of 6 original inductees to the LPGA Hall of Fame, and that was in 1967, so yes, it wasn't that long. She was also considered the most popular golfer of her day, male or female. So Charles McGrath of the New York Times wrote of her, except perhaps for Arnold Palmer, no golfer has ever been more beloved by the gallery. So she was this huge thing.
Well, that's high praise.
She was asked if she would ever retire, and she said, as long as I'm improving, I'll go on, and besides, there's too much money in the business to quit. In 1950, though, she meets this woman who's a fellow golfer called Betty Dodd, and she's a promising new star, and they are traveling around together. It was never said at the time, but Betty later basically has said this. They basically form a romantic relationship. Okay. Now, yes. George is so... loves Babe so much and I think knows what's going on. He lets her move in with them in their home in Tampa.
This is so progressive for the time. Well, they've found a way to do it.
Yeah. It's and really so George is basically like, I'm your cover. I'll run your businesses. But he genuinely loved her as well. But he also knew that.
She's very clever.
And very.
No one ever twigged.
I think some of their closest friends must have known.
In a circle. This, but, no.
But George, you know, being a massive Greek professional wrestler, you know, and if you see him, he's got a bald head and he looks like, you know, he looks like the manliest man. He was good cover. Her and Betty, both very outgoing people, they would play harmonica and they would sing together and they were invited and performed on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Oh, I thought you were going to say we're back to vaudeville. Yeah. The two of them.
But the Ed Sullivan Show.
The Ed Sullivan. Well, I want to see that
now. In the 50s, you know, like absolute stars. In 1953, she just won the Babe Zaharis tournament in Beaumont. So her own hometown had now had a tournament named after her. In 1953, she was diagnosed, her doctors diagnosed her with stage 4 colon cancer. She underwent a 3-hour operation for cancer in the early summer of 1953. She began taking practice swings with her club before the doctors released her from hospital. And just 14 weeks later, she entered the All-American tournament. So she just had this massive operation for colon cancer. On the first practice tee, watched by hundreds of photographers and sports writers and well-wishers, because they all knew she'd just had cancer and had just had this operation, she walloped the drive 250 yards, turned to the ball and said, "Man, if I had it any better, it would kill me." Despite the difficulties of wearing a colostomy bag, she finishes 15th. She's had cancer operation just before.
Yep.
A few days after that tournament, she's in the World Golf Championship and comes third, again still with a colostomy bag. So she keeps playing this. She's still LPGA president as well. In 54, she takes second at the St. Peter's Open and then won five major tournaments that year, right? Still recovering from cancer. She had a 12 straight victory in the US Women's Open, which was the big one. Her scores were 72, 71, 70, 75. It came within three strokes of the best performance by a man in the US or British Open up to that time. During 1955, doctors diagnosed that the cancer had returned. And she was operated on again. And after that, she was in excruciating pain. And it had been worked out that it had spread throughout her body. She becomes a public advocate for cancer awareness at a time when Americans just didn't talk about. She was the first ever celebrity spokesperson for the American Cancer Society. And she is such a powerhouse in talking and raising money and knowledge and getting people checked for cancer that U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower invites her on a visit to the White House purely off her cancer work.
Yeah, great.
Babe plays her very last tournament ever in 1955 at Peach Blossom Open, and she wins. By the end of the year, in increasing pain, she begins checking into and out of the John Seely Hospital, and at Christmas she visited a close friend and mentor, Bertha Bowen, who's another athlete, and she asked to be taken to a golf course, and they drove her to the new golf course. And in bathrobe and slippers, unable to walk, she knelt down on the second green and touched the grass. She still tried to play, but she couldn't play anymore at this stage. George stayed by her side the whole time.
Yep.
She said on September 27th, "George, I ain't going to die." But the next morning she woke up and had...
You're getting emotional.
Getting a bit emotional. That morning at 10:33 after her death, President Eisenhower walked into a large room, took his place behind a stand of microphones and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to take 1 minute to pay a tribute to Miss Saharis, Babe Dirksen. She was a woman who in her athletics career certainly won the admiration of every person in the United States. All sports people all over the world, and in her gallant fight against cancer, she put up one of the kind of fights that inspired us all. I think that every one of us feels that she finally had to lose this last one of all her battles."
Oh, wow. Gotcha, mate.
Got me.
You all right?
A film was made of her in 1975 called Babe, and Susan Clark played her and Alex Karras played George Zaharis, and they had only met making the picture and they married.
Oh, see, this is just good karma.
Dodd went on to win the LPGA Tour in 56 and 57, so the 2 years after Babe died.
Yeah.
Her ankle injury forced her to retire. George outlived Babe by 28 years, never got over it.
Yeah.
He married Betty Burgess, who was an actress in 1960 in Las Vegas. That didn't really work. I think that was a rebound one.
Yeah.
In 1981, she marries her childhood sweetheart, who had been married, but her husband had died. So he found some happiness later on. He spent his whole time looking after young golfers, teaching them and doing all this sort of stuff. He suffered a stroke, had pacemaker installed. He's died in 1984 from after long health. He died in Tampa, Florida on May. This was from the Colorado Springs newspaper at 76, having outlived Babe, the love of his life, by 28 years. He was inducted into the Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame Museum as part of the class of 2020.
The crying Greek from Cripple Greek. We've got a crying Greek in our studio, right?
I know. I didn't mean to get emotional, but it's such a great story. Remember they lived in the golf course?
Yes.
So he couldn't really handle it once she died and sold it to developers.
Yes.
They were trying to get planning permission, couldn't get planning permission. And in 1962, the clubhouse burnt down, so that magnificent clubhouse, it burnt down.
Yes,
the golf course falls into disrepair.
Right.
In 1974, the city of Tampa takes it over, rebuilds it, builds it up and names it the Babe Saharis Golf Course. It got heritage protection and operates to this day. One of the great reminders of one of the greatest athletes who ever lived.
There it is. Well done. We got there. Wow, finally got you.
Got me. Story's got me.
We're going to have to sit together and watch Babe and we'll get a box of Kleenex out. I got emotional in the Jimmy White episode.
Yeah. No, it's just
but that's
a great story
and it's so not of its time.
And it's not and well it's known. So... I just can't believe that story isn't.
They're all good characters.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Apart from the weight of judgment and the time and all that negative energy they had to blast through. That's a good story.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that. And that's a prejudice we must overcome. Well done. Are you all right?
I'm all right,
big fella?
I'm good. I just love that story so much.
Can we you want to go to the YouTube on this one? Yeah, you want to see him having a mate, well done. And that's what it is. You write them, you research them, you bring them to the table, and you love it.
No, it's a great one.
That's a super story. Thank you very much. Let's go and have a beer and man up. Good on you. Titus O'Reilly, well done.
If you're interested in more of Mick and I talking complete and utter nonsense, we have the Bizarre Plus members program. If you love Sports Bizarre, this gives you an extra weekly bonus podcast on top of the one you get anyway. You get access to all those previous bonus podcasts as well. You get a newsletter every fortnight. You get access to the chat room. You get the ability to vote on future episodes as well. And importantly, you get early access to any live shows we're doing. You get that before everyone else. If you're interested, the link is in the show notes.